This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It was the Cup of Underdogs, or so it seemed to be, but now Brazil with 4 World Cups and Germany with 3 have banished thoughts of Senegal, Korea, Turkey too, and to the World Cup final brought a sense of déjà vu. Simon Cooper has followed the 2002 World Cup for the Financial Times and for OneFootball.com. He will be watching from the press box in Yokohama, Japan, when Brazil and Germany meet tomorrow for the Grail. He joins me now from Japan. Simon, there did seem to be a real chance that at least one newcomer would find its way to the final, but instead, the two most successful teams in the history of the World Cup will meet. Are you surprised?
I'm not at all surprised. You know, the big teams, they always win in the end. And an underdog looks good, and people say, oh, they were really unlucky, and Korea lost by one goal. They were that close to the World Cup final. But they weren't, because the big teams, they have it under control. They sort of know what they're doing. And Brazil were always going to win this game against Turkey, for instance. Like, they were going to win every match they played. they know how far they can, you know, let the other team go. Am I disappointed? Not really. I think it would have been a shame in a way if Korea had made the World Cup final, because they got a long way partly thanks to refereeing decisions that went their way. Mm-hmm. And if they'd reached the final, people would have said, well, you know, Korea are only here because something was fixed. I don't believe something was fixed, but certainly they got help from the referees and it would have looked bad had it taken them all the way.
What about for the sport itself? Korea aside, if Turkey or Senegal or even the U.S. had made it a little bit further, made it to a final, would it have been good for soccer worldwide?
Yeah, I mean, everyone loves the underdog. And in those countries, I mean, particularly the U.S., I mean, in Turkey and Senegal, soccer can't really grow, can it? Because it's as big as it's ever going to be. It's everybody. In your country, I think it might have made a little bit of a difference if the U.S. had gone further. But I think it's also important. I mean, the World Cup is where soccer shows its face to itself and to the world every 4 years. And I think it's actually important that the top two teams have credibility. I'm not sure the Germans have credibility, but I think if the U.S. or Senegal had got to the final, a lot of people around the world would have turned their TVs off and said, this is a joke. These are not the two best teams in the world in the final. It's important that the World Cup looks good.
Let's talk a little bit about tomorrow's matchup. Germany has had an incredibly, in fact, a record-breaking defense, very strong defense. Brazil, of course, still playing samba soccer. Do we see the offense triumph over the defense?
I think Brazil will win this. I think we'll win this with little problems. I think they're going to win by one goal, but like against Turkey and England, with surprising ease. Germany, on paper, have a great defense. They have only conceded one goal in 6 games, but I think it comes down to one man. They have the best goalkeeper I can ever remember seeing. Oliver Kahn is just a phenomenon. You must have seen him there as well.
Yes, indeed.
You know, the man is amazing. He has saved, I mean, it's almost like watching a, you know, reading a cartoon book where, you know, the keeper dives to the top corner and just saves these amazing things. I mean, like in baseball, you talk about that Willie Mays catch in, was it 62?
54, but close enough.
Okay, well, you know what I mean. Well, Oliver Kahn has done that 4 times this tournament, maybe. Mm-hmm. And although nobody will ever remember a moment of this German team on the field, in the outfield, there are just moments of Oliver Kahn this tournament that you'll never forget. And the strange thing is, the guy's already 33. You know, he's even older than me. He's about the only player in the tournament who is. And he, at this late age, sort of made himself the best goalkeeper in the world, and maybe the best goalkeeper many of us can remember. But the German defense, other than him, not very special.
The German offense, of course, additionally handicapped by the fact that Michael Ballack will not be playing because of a second yellow card that he got against Korea on Tuesday. Do you look for anybody to step up and begin trying to score in his absence?
Well, I mean, they've done very well with this guy Miroslav Klose, who's of Polish origin, actually born and grew up in Poland the first 8-9 years of his life. And he scored 5 goals in the early games, but he hasn't in the last 3. I mean, they'll be looking to him, you know, if the goals are going to come, maybe from Klose, because he's not a big guy, but he's a fantastic header of the ball. He's got incredible technique. He might be the one. Otherwise, it is indeed quite hard to see who from Germany is going to score. They don't have any other natural goal scorers.
It's interesting to me that before the tournament, people talked about how Brazil had struggled to qualify, almost didn't make the tournament. And, of course, Germany had been, the people in Germany talking about the stupidity of the German team. They were too dumb to be in the World Cup. But both teams have come through at just the right time.
Well, I think the reason they've done so well this World Cup is they did struggle to qualify because they'd had the arrogance knocked out of them before they arrived. And if you look at the big teams that have disappointed, France, Italy, Argentina, they're the teams that arrived here thinking, oh, you know, we're brilliant. They qualified with ease. France didn't even have to qualify because they were already world champions. And they came, and everyone was saying, you know, these are the teams to beat. They're fantastic. And so they arrived, they were very blasé, and they lost to small teams, and they went home. Whereas Germany, Brazil, and also England fall into that category, had so much problems before they got here that as soon as they arrived, their concentration was 100%.
It strikes me that Ronaldo may be the only player in the world who can score 6 goals in the run to the final and still be characterized as perhaps not fit for the final match. What do you think?
It's amazing, isn't it? And last World Cup, he also scored about 5 goals coming into the final, and people were saying he's below his best. I think poor old Ronaldo, he's become more an idea than a footballer, and people just expect, you know, him to be like a computer game that he scores a hat-trick every match. I mean, he is tired, and he says his problem is that he hasn't really played for 2 years. For 2 years, actually, he's been busy trying to get fit for this World Cup, and he's succeeded on time. And if they win and he plays, he doesn't even have a score. If they play, he plays, it would be an amazing story. But he isn't really ready, in a sense. Not playing for 2 years means that it's an incredible physical assault on your body to do that, you know, 6-7 games in 3-4 weeks. And it's a real tribute to him. It's a wonderful story. I think he's a very, very honorable and noble footballer.
Perhaps the best chance for a really tight game in the final would be if Germany scored in the opening minutes and then Brazil had to go on the offense. Any chance that it develops that way?
Well, Germany have this funny ability to score through from the head, through the air. And so if Germany get a corner, yeah, who knows, they could score. They are very strong in those situations. They've got a big team and, you know, heading ability is strong in German football. Otherwise, very hard to see. I mean, it's a team with almost no creativity. As I say, with just one goal scorer who hasn't been firing of late. I think it's going to be 0-0 for a while. Brazil then score, you know, at some point in the match. And then the final closes down again and Brazil win 1-0.
Simon Cooper covers the World Cup for the Financial Times and for OneFootball.com. He joined us from Tokyo, Japan. Simon, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Wednesday morning semifinal World Cup match between Brazil and Turkey drew dozens of soccer fans to Café Brazil in the Brighton section of Boston. More than half of those in attendance wore Brazil's colors, though there were exceptions, such as Christine.
I'm from France, so I was definitely cheering for France. So, you know, I had to pick the next, you know, team, and I have friends from Brazil. So, you know, I'm for the best team.
After a promising early attack by Turkey, Brazil began to control much of the play. Although the game was still scoreless at the half, a Brazil fan named Paul began speaking of Turkey in the past tense, as if he knew it would certainly be his team facing Germany in the final.
Now, I always thought it was going to be a major team final. I couldn't imagine Korea being in the final. Though an Argentinian friend of mine was rooting for Turkey because he says, if Turkey wins, no one counts this World Cup, and so we'll forget that we were knocked out in the first round.
Early in the second half, the Turkish keeper sprawled in vain for a curling shot from Ronaldo, the exceptional Brazilian 6th goal of the tournament, and Marcos, the Brazilian keeper, made the goal stand up. Much to the delight of the Brazilian fans, their team spent most of the last few minutes of the match playing keep away from the Turks, turning them in frustrated circles. When the game ended, Tito, a heavyset Brazilian in a team jersey, assured me that his side would also prevail over Germany.
Of course they're going to beat, because he's the best in the world. And I knew that. I know he's going to be a champion.
Since Brazil nearly failed to qualify for the tournament at all, fumbling away opportunities in preliminary matches against the other South American teams, some observers have expressed surprise at how successfully the practitioners of Samba soccer have danced through the draw. Not Tito, though he acknowledged that some aspects of the tournament had shocked him.
Well, I'm surprised because, you know, the best team, like in the World Cup, like Italy, England, Argentina, they go first than everybody. Now we're going to the final, and I hope we're going to be the champion.
If that happens, Brazil would have its 5th World Cup. At Café Brazil on Wednesday, that outcome felt inevitable, which is why there are likely to be even more Brazil fans in attendance for the match tomorrow morning.
That's right, maybe more people, because if Brazil win, we're going to have the carnival at the parking lot. Then that's what everybody waiting for.
Brazil and Germany play at 6:30 a.m. Eastern Time, which means that if all goes according to the Brazilian plan, Carnival should begin in the parking lot in Brighton at about 8:31. after An Jung-hwan scored the goal that enabled South Korea to knock Italy from the World Cup, last week the owner of the Serie A team in Italy that employed Hwan announced that the South Korean would never again set foot in Perugia. Raged Luciano Gauci, "I am not going to pay the salary of a guy who's been the ruin of Italian soccer." Later, a spokesperson for Perugia announced that the club would welcome An back after the World Cup, an arrangement to which Mr. An had agreed. But shortly thereafter, An's agent denied Perugia's offer on behalf of his client. "They have attacked his character instead of congratulating him for his goal," the agent said. Among the clubs now said to be interested in employing Mr. An is Atletico Madrid. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Tomorrow, even as soccer's most accomplished team is being determined in Japan, the game's least impressive side will emerge in Bhutan. In a FIFA-authorized match being described as a celebration of football, the team from Bhutan, ranked number 202 in the world, will host Montserrat, ranked last at 203. Claude Hogan, the manager of the Montserrat team, claims his side will be prepared, though he acknowledges that his lads are pretty tired from 5 days of traveling to reach Bhutan on a journey that included stops in Antigua, Amsterdam, and Thailand. An enthusiastic crowd is anticipated since soccer is the second most popular sport in Bhutan, right behind archery. Underachievers, take it to our leisure, voice the burning talks, make them all the mirrors. Underachievers, total domination, kill the billion years of total frustration.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tensions between North and South Korea heat up. 4 South Korean sailors were killed, 18 wounded in a clash with North Korean patrol boats today. To read more, log on to our website, wbur.org. We are funded by you, our listeners, and by Bicon Dental Implants, providing emollient placement to final crown in only 2 patient visits. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Faulkner Hospital, 617-524-3900, or bicon.com. And by Marino's in Cambridge, introducing a new lunch menu featuring salmon risotto, butternut squash ravioli, and more. Takeout and catering available. RestauranteMoreno.com. 72 degrees in Boston right now. It is 68 at Hyannis as we come up on 720.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a friendly haven for Red Sox fans far from Fenway. But first, baseball writer Dave Kindred began a 1992 column with these words: "No more beautiful athlete ever moved on a baseball field than Willie Mays." That column is one of those recently reprised in Glove Stories, the collected baseball writings of Dave Kindred, who joins me now from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Dave, welcome to Only a Game.
Very happy to be here, Bill. Thank you.
Okay, it's 10 years since that column that I just mentioned. I just want to make sure that you still think nobody has overtaken Willie Mays.
I don't think so. I don't think anybody ever will. I still remember my father. One of the early things my father ever told me about baseball, he said, "Watch Willie Mays run. He runs like a man with sore feet." I later thought about that, and it was as if his feet barely touched the ground, as if the earth were warm under his feet. It was wonderful to watch him.
At the end of another more recent piece about home runs and home run hitters, you tell the story of the day Roger Maris stepped out of the batter's box to watch a flock of geese. Do you remember if you knew when you began that column that it would end with a story from 30-odd years earlier?
No, I didn't know that. That's kind of the magic of writing, as you know. I mean, I'm often asked, how do you get the ideas? Well, you sit down and you start writing, and you hope that at some point a third of the way through, halfway through, maybe three-fourths of the way through, you figure out what it is you're going to say. And then you go back and you try to make it really say what you want to say. And that was a story that then seemed to fit the tone and the mood of what I was writing. It's a story, actually, that Tony Kubek had told once about the umpire Nestor Shylak, that Shylak understood the pressure Maris was under when a flock of geese flew over Tiger Stadium. He allowed Maris just to step out of the box and watch these geese as they passed over. Just a moment of peace in this madhouse of chasing Babe Ruth. Then he stepped back in and hit a home run, of course.
Of course he did, and what a story it became. I wonder, given what you've just said about writing, whether when people ask you about writer's block, you give them the same answer that I do. I can't afford writer's block. I have to keep writing.
I have to keep paying the bill. You know, that's one of the joys of doing what I do, which is, you know, I write columns. I've written them. I hesitate to think how many I've written, but I've been writing them for almost 40 years, you know, thousands of columns, and there is no such thing for me as writer's block. You just keep writing. You know, someone a long time ago told me the formula, the KISS theory of writing, keep it simple, stupid. Whenever I feel the story overwhelming me, I go back and just try to write it as simply as I can, and then maybe pretty it up. I think of E.B. White. I think of William Strunk, who always said, omit needless words. Sometimes I've written columns and then started omitting needless words, and I don't wind up with enough words to fill the column. So then I have to start over.
That's, or else get some needless words back in there.
To me, the writer's block is, I've never suffered that. I hope never to. It's just too much fun to me to get to a point where you actually write something that you didn't know you were going to write, and that makes it all worthwhile.
In a 1994 column, you wrote about Julie Croteau, who played for the late lamented Colorado Silver Bullets. At least they're lamented by me. Do you miss them?
Yes. I wrote a little book about them, in fact. Julie Croteau was one of the key figures in that book. Colorado Silver Bullets, women who go toe-to-toe with the men.
Mm-hmm.
I was amazed to watch them play. Every one of them had been softball players. When you move from a 60-foot baseline to a 90-foot baseline, you move from throwing it underhand from 45 feet to throwing it overhand from 60 feet. It's an entirely different game, and I was just always astonished by how good they were. Phil Niekro,
mm-hmm.
the great old Brave pitcher, was the manager. Took no guff, you know, and he said that he would be part of that enterprise as long as it wasn't a circus. He never allowed it to be a circus. It was always a baseball team. Still remember a pitcher named Ann Williams coming to Niekro with a baseball and saying, Phil, how do you hold this?
It's the start on page one.
Niekro had been in baseball, of course, by then for 60 years. He'd never been asked that question. So he had to actually literally show her how to hold it. Actually, he just said, however's comfortable. And then she became a decent pitcher for him.
In a column entitled Mining for Gold Among Cornfields, you write about the old scouts and how they work the bushes trying to find prospects. I wonder if you have found, as I have, that the best baseball stories come from old men and rookies rather than from the guys in between.
When I went through my work at the Sporting News to choose the columns for this book, I chose stories that had nothing to do with dollar signs,
mm-hmm.
nothing to do with the money and the finances. And that's what people like Ellsworth Brown, the old scout in Illinois, who's been a scout for almost 65 years. I knew him when I was a kid player. He'd come to watch us play. I always made sure that my socks were pulled up the requisite height so that he might mistake me for Mickey Mantle out there. That never happened. I didn't really know it until I got old enough to really understand that it was the love of the game, really, that has kept my attention all these years. I'm able to see it between the lines and try to block out the rest of the big business aspect of it now.
Do you ever find yourself thinking that with a break here or there, you could have been one of those guys that the sports writers write about rather than doing the writing yourself?
Not on your life. It's one of the things that I do admire about professional athletes is that they, you know, my body was never going to let me be what I wanted to be. You know, I realized that one day at Illinois Wesleyan when we had a freshman pitcher come in named Dick Burwell, who that year signed a $100,000 bonus contract with the Cubs. I stood in against him one day. I couldn't see the ball. I said, wait a minute. This is different.
Yeah.
And then I played second base alongside a shortstop named Doug Rader. Doug Rader was 6'4", 220. I was 5'7", 150. Doug Rader was faster than I was, could do everything exponentially better than I could. And I said, wait a minute. Maybe I better learn to type. Marvin Miller, a long time ago, the old boss of the Players Association, said that Major League Baseball players are the least replaceable workers he's ever seen because they're so highly skilled at such a difficult job. And so, I never had any illusions that I could be one of those people.
Somebody asked Tom Boswell that question one time, and he said, no, I have a higher calling.
Well, I would not say that. You know, I would telling the stories is important. It's not a higher calling than being in the arena. Being in the arena is still the best place to be. But telling the story in a way that puts people as close to that arena, to give them the feel of that arena, to let them know what it is like in there, is an important thing to do. It's not a higher calling than doing it, but it's good.
Dave Kindred wrote the columns, which have been collected in Glove Stories, published by the Sporting News. Dave, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, Bill, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Red Sox fans bristle when New Yorkers chant 1918, a reference to the last time the Sox won the World Series. They don't like it when Yankees fans calmly cite the 26 times their team has won the Fall Classic over the last 74 years, and they really don't like to be reminded of Bucky Dent. So it was with considerable trepidation that lifelong Red Sox fan Mitch Wertlieb recently went in search of a rumored safe haven located mysteriously behind enemy lines.
When I first heard of the Riviera Cafe, I thought it had to be an elaborate joke aimed at the beleaguered Boston sports nut. After all, how could a sports bar that lays out the welcome mat for Red Sox fans exist smack dab in New York City? Even though I worried I'd walk into some kind of sinister trap, I decided to get in the car and head down I-95 to see for myself if I could really cheer openly for Noma and Pedro without fear of reprisal deep in the heart of Gotham.
Rolando Araujo makes his first start of the season for Boston. Mike Mussina will look for his second win in as many starts against the Bo Sox.
It was early June. As I reached the Manhattan Bridge, I listened to the local radio broadcast just before my first-place Sox took on the second-place Yankees. When I reached the Riviera Cafe in Greenwich Village, I was delighted to find the game on most of the cafe's 21 TV screens.
As we renew this rivalry here on Fox, the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees.
Other than a photograph of former Sox hurler and current Yankee Roger Clemens decked out in his old Sox uniform, there wasn't anything that indicated the Riviera was safe. So I kept my Red Sox cap safely stored away and asked the cafe's assistant manager, Mauricio Guerrero, why the Riviera is such a good place for Red Sox fans.
I believe that we don't pick sides, and that's we're a business, and we don't go Yankees.
As the game got underway, Sox fans, mostly transplanted Bostonians, had clustered together and were clearly in the majority. The first thing I wanted to know was how they had found out about the place.
A friend of mine in Boston told me about this place, so that you know, this was a place that Red Sox fans come to watch the games when they're especially when they're playing the Yankees. And it actually didn't make any sense to me because I'd been here a few times years ago. And I was like, there are no Boston bars, no Red Sox fan bars in New York, but surprisingly enough, there was.
Well, it's one thing to hear that from a Red Sox fan. So I asked the bartender on duty, Lisa Radasta, if it's really a partisan crowd that bellies up to the bar when the Sox are on.
Usually, yeah. Maybe like two-thirds of the bar would be filled with Red Sox fans. I don't know if I should say this. I don't know if I should include it, but they're usually better tippers and everything because they get better. They know that they can come here and then it's going to be a good environment. It's not going to be like, you suck, da, da, da. You know, get out of here, Yankees, Yankees. You know, so they know that, and they'll come for that.
So, satisfied that this indeed was a little piece of Red Sox heaven in Lower Manhattan, I left Lisa a hefty tip, donned the cap I'd been afraid to openly display, and settled in to hear more about this home away from home. I wondered aloud what happens when an unsuspecting Yankees fan wanders into the Riviera.
I've seen some Yankee fans get tossed out of here. Just from being Yankee fans, you know. My name's Andrew.
You live in New York City now?
I live in Jersey City.
And do you come here specifically to watch the Red Sox?
Yes, I do. We've been coming down here for the last couple of years to watch the Sox. You know, it's a great place to watch it. And you know, I found out through my brother, you know, where to watch the games. You know, it's just a great place, you know, Boston fans to get together.
You ever think you'd find a place like this?
Oh, yeah. It's New York City. You know, there's a home for us Bostonians.
Excuse me, sir. Can we bug you for a minute?
Oh, no, you don't need to interview me. I'm a Yankee fan, though. Man. This place is loaded with Red Sox fans. You know that, don't you?
Yeah, that's what we want to ask you about. What's it like for you coming into a bar in the middle of New York City and seeing a bunch of Red Sox fans?
It's a very strange feeling, let me tell you. I said, where the hell am I? Are you in New York or am I in Boston? And what are they doing here? Where do they come from anyway? And they're outrooting us over here. They're all over the place. What's going on anyway? It's like a revolution all over again in Boston Tea Parties in New York.
We are everywhere.
All over the place. No, it makes a lot of fun, though, you know. But I can't yell and scream too much because I'm outnumbered, you know. But, you know, I'm a Yankee fan. I'm so used to winning. I know that sounds arrogant, but, you know, that's the way it is.
Well, he's right. On the day of my visit, the Sox fell to the Yankees 10-2. But that didn't dampen my spirits, because I had uncovered a secret. In New York, there's a neighborhood sports bar where the sting of a Sox loss will always be soothed by kindred spirits.
Guys, thanks for talking to us. We'll get him next time, huh?
For Only a Game, I'm Mitch Wertlieb in New York.
Torres is on the mound, dead comes up, bounces a foul ball right off his foot. Torres hurries the following throw, over the wall, Bucky's pop-up goes. Whoa!
Now we've seen it all before. We've watched countless times as they've tied the score. But nothing in our history has caused more lament than the homer we gave up to that man.
Bucky, Bucky, Bucky Dent. Bucky, Bucky, Bucky Dent. Bucky, Bucky, Bucky Dent. They won. Bucky, Bucky, Bucky Dent. Bucky, Bucky, Bucky Dent. Bucky, Bucky, Bucky Dent. Song's done.
You're listening to Only a Game. Toward the top of the cyber mailbag this week was a note from John Newton, who hears Only a Game on KIOS in Omaha, Nebraska. He emailed to express his disappointment that we didn't cover the College World Series this time around, but regarding other matters baseball, Tom Connell of East Providence, Rhode Island, appreciated my recent conversation with Ira Burko about, among other things, the eloquence of Casey Stengel. Mr. Connell emailed his favorite Stengel one-liner, which followed the manager's dismissal by the Yankees after the 1960 World Series. Said Case, "I'll never make the mistake of being 70 again." Mr. Stengel followed up that promise with, quote, "There comes a time in everyone's life, and I've had plenty of them." Kerry Doyle and Tom Rivato, both WBUR listeners, and Bertrand Hamilton, who hears us on WRVT in Vermont, were among the many who wrote to say thank you for the soccer coverage during the World Cup tournament. Ann Stansel of Tallahassee, Florida, has been enjoying that coverage, too, but not without some dismay. "I'm about to go crazy over the use of country names as plural words," she wrote. "I'm sick of hearing phrases like Costa Rica continue going forward and Brazil lead 2-1. Are FIFA or the commentators trying to change the way we treat group nouns in some worldwide idiomatic shift? I'll settle for watching the games on Univision, where, out of my ignorance of the Spanish language, I can blissfully ignore the grammatical mistakes." Finally, much of the email in response to last week's program had to do with a single piece of music, a little gem entitled Giant Robots, which we ran after an interview with an inventor competing in the Soccer RoboCup 2002 tournament in Japan. Brian Canny in Dallas, George Russell in Cleveland, and Michael Bonner in McClellanville, South Carolina, were among the many who wanted to know who had recorded that song. It was a group called Berserk on their 1994 eponymous release. Your emailed comments on the program will reach us at oag@wbur.bu.edu. An even easier way to make that connection is to visit our website, onlyagame.org, where you can click on Contact and let us know what you think. To record your comments, call the listener line, 617-353-1860, or write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
Flying from the sky, in the blink of an eye, with giant robot.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour. Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks worldwide for over 10 years. Detailed information on current computer virus threats available at sophos.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by J.N. Phillips Auto Glass, featuring 57 years of experience, 40 locations, 110 mobile vans, and industry-certified technicians committed to safe installation standards. 1-877-AUTOGLASS. Good morning, I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Boston Red Sox dropped to a half game behind the New York Yankees after last night's 4-2 loss to the Atlanta Braves. Interleague play between the Braves and the Sox continues today at Fenway. In Major League Soccer, the New England Revolution hosts New York, New Jersey this afternoon, and the Boston Breakers host San Jose. In the forecast, pleasant weather, mostly sunny skies today, not too humid. Highs in the lower 80s and the 70s on the Cape and the Islands. Highs tomorrow in the 80s. There's a slight chance of isolated thunderstorms tomorrow night after midnight. Hot and humid conditions take hold for the first half of the next work week. Monday's highs near 90, scattered thunderstorms, a forecast to return for Tuesday and Wednesday. Highs Tuesday and Wednesday in the 90s. If you're searching for ideas for something to do tonight or this weekend, check out our arts calendar. You'll find listings for gallery exhibits, music events, book readings, and more. It's on the web at wbur.org. 72 degrees in Boston at 7:39.
Hi, this is Alex Chadwick. More than any place I've been in Europe, Venice is travel in time. Walk through the streets of the City of Canals. No cars, no motor scooters, just footsteps, the people around you, history, and a cafe or two. Join me for the next Citizens of the World Tour New Year's in Venice. Travel in time and help pay for the news of today, and what better way to do it?
For more information, call 800-909-9287.
Bill Littlefield coming up on Only a Game, the ladies who lock and load. But first, Charlie Pierce, our analyst, joins me to discuss the sports news of the week, this week from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The NBA draft occurred on Wednesday evening. Yao Ming, the 7'5" Chinese center, was the first pick, as many had predicted that he would be. Slovenia, Brazil, Yugoslavia, and Italy also provided first-round picks, as did Cypress Creek High School. Remember when going to a Division I college was the route of choice to the NBA?
Well, the interesting thing about this draft was that going to a Division I college and staying at least 3 years was the plan, because the people that were hurt most this year were not necessarily the high schoolers, because very few of them came out in the first place, but the people who came out of college after one or two seasons, because they're the ones whose slots were all swallowed up by the foreign players.
Mm-hmm.
The most interesting thing in the draft for me was I absolutely cannot fathom what the Denver Nuggets are doing. They traded Antonio McDyess, who when healthy is one of the 10 best players in the league, to the New York Knicks for a Brazilian guy whom nobody has ever seen play, Mark Jackson, who's 153 years old, and Marcus Camby, who isn't healthy for two consecutive hours since he hit the NBA. Denver must be awfully convinced that Nene Hilario can play. Otherwise, they've just devastated their team for another 3 years.
The draft having passed, Charlie, we are now almost in the NBA's free agent signing period. Will we see more big trades and NBA superstars changing uniforms as budgets are hammered into balance?
Well, I suspect as they use the Procrustean salary cap to excuse their own cowardice and blunders, you'll see a lot of this. The most intriguing player, I think, is Andre Miller, an excellent, excellent point guard from the Cleveland Cavaliers who do not want to pay him an extension. He's being shopped all over the league. He was supposed to go to the Clippers, oddly enough, 2 weeks ago. That hasn't happened yet. Now there's some talk about him going to two or three other places. He's a very valuable commodity, and there are a lot of teams that could use him.
The National Hockey League will, of course, also be signing and slashing. Hockey's free agent situation will be complicated by the retirement of Red Wings goalie Dominik Hasek. Would you care to give us your favorite stories about the nimble netminder?
Well, I think, you know, he did the what will rapidly become known as the Raymond Bourque George Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award this year by going to a team at the end of his career and winning a Stanley Cup and getting to hoist the Stanley Cup. It's just his complete lack of classic design as a goaltender, his ability to flop and flail and lose his stick and drop his glove and have a skate fall off and still stop the puck.
That's not
it was
bad.
Something
I like
extremely
it.
Idiot savant about the way he played the position.
As if it hadn't been a rough enough week since the death of St. Louis broadcaster Jack Buck, the St. Louis Cardinals lost 33-year-old pitcher Darryl Kyle, who died last Saturday in his sleep. The preliminary coroner's report cited the blockage of two of Kyle's coronary arteries. Should Kyle's death be regarded as just a fluke, or does it once again call into question that relationship between players and teams and team doctors?
Well, it does that a little bit. First of all, it's everyone who travels for a living's nightmare to die alone in your hotel room. But I am frankly stunned that Darryl Kyle, having been traded a couple times and having been picked up as a free agent and having signed an enormous contract, that a cardiovascular workup of some sort wasn't part of the standard team physical. With that kind of an investment, I would think you would check everything. I was very surprised to learn that it wasn't.
Charlie, we spent the first part of the program discussing the odd way in which a World Cup characterized by surprises has produced two completely unsurprising finalists, Brazil and Germany. You knew it would work out this way all along, right?
Absolutely. As I predicted 3 weeks ago, that it would be Germany and Brazil. Now, I think that you'll see this sometimes in tennis, where there'll be a lot of upsets in the first and second round, and whatever putative favorites are left have an easy path to face each other. It's part of what makes the NCAA tournament so charming, is most of your upsets take place in the early rounds. This year, you had a couple of teams in the Final Eight and the Final Four of the World Cup who weren't expected to be there. But in general, you've got two of the multinational corporations of international soccer playing.
Do you have a pick among the multinational corporations?
Well, I love the Brazil. I mean, how can you not love the Brazilians? The flair, the joie de vivre, the fact that they actually try to score. I'm very Brazilian this weekend.
On Tuesday, in the dugout of the San Francisco Giants, teammates Barry Bonds and Jeff Kent were pushing each other around. Who do you like in that heavyweight matchup?
Absolutely no one. Having had some personal experience with both men, they are neither very likable nor very cooperative. Jeff Kent was famous, of course, a couple of years ago for bad-mouthing Barry Bonds in the pages of a national magazine. Bonds, of course, took offense to that. They will now not speak to us about them. They will probably not speak to each other. At this point, I wish Dusty Baker all the best in his next career as a fishing guide somewhere in the Yukon.
Elsewhere in baseball, the Expos acquired Bartolo Colon from Cleveland in a six-player swap. What next? The Twins pick up Barry Bonds, Curt Schilling, and the ghost of Honus Wagner, and we have a Montreal-Minnesota World Series after all?
This is clearly a job for that veteran baseball scribe, Niccolo Spikes Machiavelli. Because, first of all, the Expos are supposed to be gone. The Expos are not supposed to exist. The Expos are now a wholly owned subsidiary of Major League Baseball. What are they doing making trades that might make them a contender? Second of all, Cleveland is dumping salary. Cleveland has decided that it has gone as far as this group of players will take it. They are cleaning house in Cleveland. But the question becomes, does baseball want the Expos to be gone, or does baseball want the Expos to succeed? Because it's baseball that made this trade. It's Major League Baseball that agreed to this trade, which made better a team that Major League Baseball has so far pretended it wants to rid itself of.
It was a tough week at Wimbledon for Pete Sampras and Andre Agassi, both of whom were bounced. And it was also a tough week for tennis commentator John McEnroe, whose ex-wife accused him of taking cocaine and steroids in the 80s. She cannot be serious, right?
Well, she seems to be dead serious about it. This is one of the problems, of course, when you tour a tell-all book and you do not tell what the world considers to be all. I have no way to verify what the former Mrs. McEnroe and former Tatum O'Neill had to say. You know, it's unfortunate that Dirty Laundry gets aired, but if you do manage to air, you know, the dress shirts and dress slacks, sooner or later somebody will go out there and air the dirty underwear and socks for you.
Finally, Charlie, Aaron Bright, former high school wrestling coach at Avon, Indiana, has resigned from that position after the school board learned that in order to inspire his wrestlers, Bright bit off the head of a live bird. However, he will stay on as a teacher, so maybe the school board feels that the time-tested geeking method will work for Mr. Bright's geography and history students.
And in staying on as a classroom history teacher, he has turned down a chance to be the new lead singer for Black Sabbath on their reunion tour.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and for Esquire magazine as well. He's a regular here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Just an election or two ago, the constituency of choice was soccer moms. Maybe they'll still matter the next time we elect a president. On the other hand, maybe the next sports-related female voting bloc will be Calamity Janes. Only a Game's Michelle Seaton has this report.
What we're going to be looking at on our firearms is sight alignment, trigger squeeze, grip of the firearm, okay?
Five women hold 22 caliber semi-automatics. They are standing in the pistol range in the basement of the Leominster Sportsmen's Association in Leominster, Massachusetts. They listen as Timory Mickett prepares them to shoot paper targets hanging downrange.
This is your magazine. This is your cartridge. Okay, you're going to want to load this in here. Like that.
Mm-hmm.
Slide the magazine in. Finger off the trigger. You want to pull the slide back. Okay.
This is part of a day-long program called Women on Target, created in 1994 by the National Rifle Association. The NRA sends money and instructional materials to gun clubs around the country hosting this program, which teaches women about gun safety and gives them a chance to do some shooting.
Okay. Whenever you're ready.
All set?
Yep.
Great job.
How'd you do, Irene?
I got holes.
Oh, good girl.
I'm so excited. Thank you.
No problem. How's everyone feel? Good? Ready to go again?
In the morning, the women spend time shooting handguns, rifles, and shotguns. In the afternoon, the women hear the NRA's standard lecture on handgun safety that in some states, including Massachusetts, satisfies the educational requirement in the application for a license to carry. Jonathan Green, Director of Training and Education at the Gun Owners Action League of Massachusetts, insists that this is not a program to encourage women to buy guns.
First, we're not trying to make anybody a firearms expert. We are trying to make people firearms safety experts. And secondly, to introduce them to the shooting sports. So what we're trying to do is shed light on all the positive uses of firearms.
Those would include hunting and competitive sport shooting. And according to Green, more and more women are interested in owning guns for protection.
They're learning that you can fire guns without the possibility of injury if you follow a few basic safety rules, common sense rules. So it's amazing to see people that have years ago shunned even considering owning a firearm for protection. Now they're coming out, they want to learn all about it.
What Green might not know is that many of the women here today already own guns or live with people who do.
I can't even think of them all. Rifles, pistols,
black powder, shotguns.
Melissa Parker of Sterling, Massachusetts, has been shooting with her husband on and off for about 3 years.
I actually have my own little rifle that I use. You know, I mean, just different. I have my own little pistol, you know, so I mean, I have my own guns, but it's just been too long since I've been able to shoot them.
She stopped shooting during her recent pregnancy. Now that her baby is 3 weeks old, she is using this course as a refresher. She says that any woman who lives with a gun owner should take a course like this.
I think anybody with guns in the house should know how to handle a gun. If ever a child came across a gun and your husband wasn't home, I think that the wife or mother should know how to handle it and properly take it away from the child without causing more problems, basically.
Helen Dietrich of Quincy, Massachusetts, goes to a shooting range once a week with her husband to put 50 rounds through her Smith & Wesson. She is here to get more comfortable with her gun.
Like when it jams or a bullet doesn't go into the chamber, that sort of thing. That's when you have to have the confidence to know that, yes, I dropped the magazine, I can open the chamber, I know what I'm doing. As long as the gun is working fine, hey, anybody can aim at point and shoot. It's when something goes wrong, you have to have the confidence to know what you're doing.
Sue Hess of Andover, Massachusetts, shoots competitively once a week at her local gun club. She enjoys pistols so much that she wants to try rifles and skeet shooting.
But this is a great sport for women because we can compete with men on an equal standing, which I think is great. Even if you're not athletic, you can compete with men.
Is that the feeling of power?
While one group is learning about pistols, another shoots balloons on a rifle range, and another shoots clay targets with 20-gauge shotguns, which are small enough that the recoil won't bruise them or knock them over. Instructors know that those are the two biggest fears that women bring with them to the shooting range, particularly if their first experience of shooting was with a man.
Yeah. Melissa's ready to go again. You can see the look on her face. Funny how that is once you take that first shot.
Irene Grablauskas had never fired a gun before today. When she signed up for this course, her main fear was that one of the other students might accidentally shoot her. Now she's fired a semi-automatic pistol with laser sights and has shot a clay target out of the air. She says she can't wait to get to the rifle range. To her, this is a fun way to spend a Saturday morning.
I mean, it's just, you know, it's kind of like throwing darts. Can you hit the bullseye? It's like you can or you can't. You know, you don't really have to wait for a nice long outcome. So it's immediate. Mm-hmm. Immediate gratification. Look at it that way.
Grablauskas is exactly the kind of student instructor Timory Mickett hopes will attend these clinics.
It's so important to get females involved in it and also young people. You know, I go to my gun club meetings and I'm the only female there, also the only person under 30. So I think it's really important that we get the message out there.
Mickett says that women gun owners face a cultural stigma. That's why she's wearing her .40 caliber Glock on a side holster. Unloaded, of course.
I think it's, again, to detach people from that stigma, to see a female my age, you know, walking around with a firearm on her side. And I think people initially could be taken aback from that or get a second glance when I walk into a room, but, you know, it's not an abnormal thing.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to put a cartridge in the chamber. We'll close the chamber. And I want you to aim right for the belly of the ram. See the ram?
NRA instructors say they like teaching women because they listen. They follow all the safety rules. And as a result, they are remarkably good shots.
Look at that smile, Melissa. That's fantastic. There you go.
The NRA will be sponsoring events like this one in gun clubs all around the country in the hopes of getting the message out to women that shooting is safe and fun. It's an attitude gun advocates hope women will take with them into shooting ranges, gun shops, and ultimately into the voting booth.
You're a natural, Melissa. You are a natural. Pull the bolt up. Good. All the way back. Excellent.
For Only a Game, I'm Michelle Seaton in Leominster, Massachusetts.
Okay. Now you're going to load.
Oh, my mother was frightened by a shotgun, they say. That's why I'm such a wonderful shot. I'd be out in the cactus and I'd practice all day. And now tell me, what have I got? I'm quick on the trigger with targets not much bigger. bigger than a pinpoint. I'm number one. But my score with a feller is lower than a seller. Oh, you can't get a man with a gun.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from April Peavy, Karen Pelland, Glenn Alexander, Keith Infantino, John Hoder, Vince Fairchild, the Boston Globe's John Powers, Cliff Bentley at Minnesota Public Radio, and Manoli Wetherill at NPR in Washington. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, sign up for our newsletter or revel with the Red Sox rooters in Gotham, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from shooting neophyte Irene Grablauskas, who reveals what it was that kept her off the shooting range until recently.
I was actually concerned about my own safety.
Yeah, why do you think Michelle Seton got that story assignment and I stayed home? Wow! I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
I shot a rabbit. Some furrier would grab it for a coat that would warm someone. But you can't shoot a lover and use him for a cover. Oh, you can't get a man.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from Strategic Science and Technologies Incorporated, creators of Warm Cream, a patented cream for relief of cold hands and feet, naturally. Available on the web, warmcream.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. This is WBUR.